Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone, thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of this show, recognize they're on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person, share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength, capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulder, deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is Part Sinner, Part Saint on Late Night Poets After Midnight. We are a group on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are, because you can talk to us in the chat, and you can read the poems as we do. I'm Aphasiana, and with me I have Robbie. Hi, Robbie.
Hello, how's it going?
Oh, you know, lots of snow, so I'm a little tired from all the shoveling. How are you?
Not too bad. We don't have so much the shoveling, but the, I always like to kind of calibrate people's understanding of the temperatures this way. Like, minus 40 degrees Celsius is minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. That's where the two meet. And in the last couple of days, it's gone down to, like, minus around 30 C. So that gives people an idea, and they always just go, oh, my God, well, how do you live where you lived?
We were like that about 2 weeks ago. This week is not as bad. I think it's quite a bit warmer. Doesn't feel as bad anymore anyway. That, like, hurt to be outside. No, today's only, like, minus 7. It's not bad at all. But it was like that 2 weeks ago, so I feel your pain.
Oh, yeah.
Alrighty. So today we have two contests that we're going to cover. The first one was inspired by Rudy Francisco's poem. Rudy is a poet who has books through Button Poetry, and he does spoken word. So I am just envious of his talent, and he's amazing. So this is a poem from his book, and it's called When People Ask How I'm Doing. When people ask how I'm doing, I want to say, my depression is an angry deity, a jealous god, a thirsty shadow that wrings my joy like a dish rag and makes juice out of my smile. I want to say, getting out of bed has become a magic trick. I'm probably the worst magician I know. I want to say, the sadness is the only clean shirt I have left, and my washing machine has been broken for months. But I'd rather not ruin someone's day with my tragic honesty. So instead, I treat my face like a pumpkin. I pretend that it's Halloween, and I carve it into something acceptable. I laugh, and I say, I'm doing all right. So with my contest here, what I asked people to do was to write something similar where if someone asks how they are, how can they be more honest about it using metaphors, and what are the things that you maybe wouldn't say but want to do? So I actually really hate when people ask how I am, usually because it's usually, like, people don't mean it, and it's just kind of like a pleasantry. So then I have that awkward moment of, like, how much do I lie right now? and I'm a terrible, terrible, terrible liar. So I just kind of went with that, and we're going to see how people are feeling or how they're willing to say that they are feeling. And we're going to start with one by Lama Ra. And Robbie, I'm going to get you to read that one, except I'm going to actually paste it. One second. I copied the wrong thing. Here we go.
So how are you doing? it's too easy a joke to me.
You're
if
evil.
I didn't make that joke this show, I wouldn't. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to get serious now and read this poem. I'm not okay. Departed, rivers uncharted. My dreams touch your hands and the days barely started. Paradise is your garden, but hell is my memory. My tears are the dagger that bleed all my energy. My work day is a dragon. Believe what the fire breathes. Melancholy moods, but my smile always hiding me. Sun danced to dry the leaves, but I'd rather rain pride. Happy you're at peace, but I hate it when the days cry. Hoping that you'd say hi, saving all your voicemails, holding all your secrets, and I promise that I won't tell, missing you the days pass. But it seems the pain lasts. My bed is quicksand, and my heart is like a plane crash. My soul wants to hold you. My eyes want to grace you with you in your last moments. So I guess I should be grateful, but I'm hateful that God took your beautiful soul, and I'll never see you smile with that beautiful glow. End poem.
Oh, wow. This is a really powerful and beautiful poem, but it's even more powerful when you read the AN, dedicated to my late daughter. Wow. Well, first of all, Lamra, I'm so sorry for your loss. That is just heartbreaking. And you do this so beautifully, expressing your grief. And, you know, of course, you're not feeling okay after that. My bed is quicksand part is great because you feel trapped in bed when you're depressed. It's like it sucks you in, and getting out of it feels impossible sometimes. So I think the quicksand part there was really smart. And heart is like a plane crash, absolutely. The way that he uses weather in this, the smile is hiding, the sun danced to dry the leaves, the rain, it's just there's so much in here where it connects to nature and to feelings, but I'm seeing it like in a new light now that I've read the AN, because when it says when I'd rather rain pride, you know, to feel the pride watching her grow up and succeed. I hate it when the days cry. So when the days cry, part of that I'm imagining rain, but it's when it's for him, it's overwhelming. Sorry, I'm not being articulate because this is just such an emotional piece. I think he did a wonderful job at expressing it, and this definitely fits with the topic. And it's one of those things where people are constantly asking if you're okay if something bad happens, and how do you answer that? When you're not, and how do they respond to you saying that you're not? It's tricky. What did you think, Robbie?
Well, when you spoke on your last point, it made me think about the other end of it too, where sometimes you're thinking to yourself, well, probably being asked a gazillion times, you know, how are you? Are you feeling okay? And you're kind of reluctant to ask because you know that they've probably been asked so much, but then at the same time, you're kind of like wondering, well, am I going to seem aloof or not caring if I don't ask? And so it can be a hard thing to figure, you know, what side of the coin that is. I definitely really like the quicksand part as well. Is just such a visceral way of expressing what it all feels like. And there's something here that's a classic, what I call it's a cold comfort sort of a thing. So I guess I should be grateful, but I'm hateful that God took your beautiful soul. It's kind of like when people say things like, well, you know, they're in heaven now at least, or, you know, they're at peace. And it's maybe not quite the strongest example of it, but I think of those quote-unquote cold comforts where, you know, people say, well, at least it's this or at least it's that. And it's not really like when people say, I don't know how other people feel about it, but when it says, well, you know, this experience made you stronger. And when people say that to me, it does not jive with me at all. And so I got that a little bit from the, I guess I should be grateful, but I'm hateful. And there was another part in the poem where that was kind of what I picked up to or reminded me of that. I'm just trying to remember where it was. But overall in the poem, it really expressed well the feeling of where it's like every day is just such a struggle. Just the everyday regular things and everything, like the bed. You know, and your mood and everything. And so, yeah, it expressed that very well.
I also hate when people say what you've been through made you stronger. No, it didn't. It made everything else harder. It's like it doesn't actually work that way. I mean, maybe it revealed strength that was already there, but it didn't make me stronger. It made me weaker. And then I had this other friend who we both had kind of traumatic things, and whenever someone says what you've been through makes you stronger, she goes, actually, it makes me awkward at parties. She's like, because I'm too blunt. I don't know. She said it better than that, but it was sort of like, no, it's not so much stronger as weirder. And our next poem is by Matt29. This is called How Are You Doing? Entering the staff room, I feel when you asked, how are you today, like I'm not really seen sometimes. An empty chair, witnessing the office banter, where my invite never felt a pen's expression. I want to say, the detachment cuts into me like shards of glass, knowing the sundial can't run quick enough. Loneliness recognizes me as its plaything. I want to say, workmates pass through me as though a ghost, neither seeing or hearing the water draining away, where work is a mask of friendliness to wear. Instead, I pretend I'm popular with hellos everywhere, being trouble-free and not needing a hug. I listen to them, putting them first, and say, I'm doing okay, thank you. End poem. Robbie, can you start the comments, please?
Putting them first is the thing that struck me the firstly, because it can be such a crappy feeling for putting someone first, or feeling that you need to, or that you should for some reason, or you feel like that it's the obligation for you to do that, when really it's quite the opposite. You want to be the one that's being put first in that situation. And there's that whole detachment thing here. What's that? Like, it has the word detachment. The detachment cuts into me like shards of glass. And it talks about how the workmates pass through like a ghost. And there's different types of detachments. Like there's, you're like kind of just on autopilot in that. But then that's such an awful type of detachment where you feel like you're numb, you know? And to me, that's like about one of the worst feelings that you can have. It's like, it's so dispassionate. It's like when you can't even be bringing yourself. Well, I was going to say bring yourself to care. That's not quite the right thing, but your feelings are just numbed. And I just thought it was interesting. There's actually like when you scroll up, it's like almost like there's another poem up there. I was kind of curious about that because I don't know if that was that's the prompt. Okay, I was going to ask that if that was the prompt. Okay, so yeah, I like that he had the prompt that they had the prompt with the poem up side by side like that, just to see, could see, you know, more directly what the inspiration was. And it kind of, the way he did it, it was like it looks like a letter, actually, which I liked. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it actually looks like a letter to a person. So I thought that was pretty cool, like a visual to bring forth the idea.
Great comments. I like that he chose the workplace for it, because that is a place where you do have a certain expectation to put on a front. People don't necessarily want you whining and bringing your personal problems to work. And especially if you work with customer service, if you have like a front-facing job, you kind of have to paint on that smile, which can be really hard. And to have to keep it on in the staff room is even harder, because sometimes you're lucky and you have you know, a good camaraderie with your coworkers, and you get that break from the customers where you connect with each other. But that's not always there. And I really like the way that he put an empty chair witnessing the office banter. That really shows the feeling of being invisible and just being, like, in the background sort of thing, like, to notice that he's not noticed. Using the empty chair, I thought, was clever there. And then that's reinforced when he talks about being walked through like a ghost. Yeah, this is good. He got the prompt, and he wrote well to it. It's your turn to read again, Robbie.
Okay. The right answer is the next one. Okay, yeah. Sometimes it's not too long before you lose track of whether you're refreshed or not and everything. The right answer. How are you doing? Looking well, without a pause between. To do the Bukowski at home, far from happy party land, where death and grief are banned. Answers of slow incubation, stanzas of golden chickens, full grown, plucked, stuffed for Thanksgiving. A creative buck in apron, sing the song of Simple Simon, fowl pie baked in wine and oven. Risen pastry from heaven. How's it cooking, poet, alone in recipe's kitchen? A self-satisfied glutton, selfie on iPhone, King Kong in person, shoving it in. Hansel and Gretel to drop in, ask Big Book, what you doing? Looking well, no question. Oh, burnt children, never to ask, what's one writing in this life missing? Peter Pan, Crocodile, and Captain Book, my mortal clock a ticking, thickening. Scientists in field of specialization, deaf doctors telling me how I'm going, prescription writing. Grammatical confusion, a naked answer, not getting well, more confusing than ever. Universe expanding, pie cooling, taste of little chicken brewing. A deviant's yum, Mr. Whippy and gun, answers all wrong. Mama from Babylon, father in casket of non-cognition, pine, St. Peter with idle ambition. Words of replies to collide, dishwasher cursing, once a team player, well agreeing. Pen and quill and gut inflation, mad as exploding hospitals, cyclops with trolley moving. But barnyard love? Yes, to vote for the rest of unhurried creation, alone in my unmeasured room. Accordion squeezing, clap sticks in undies, red nappies, cows of solemn milking, teats ringing, morning, a daisy, Lucy, naming everyone a mooing. How you doing? No need asking. Buck in barn fielding all equations. Question. Jesus in heaven, demons in basement. Time in abeyance? Blackbirds for breakfast. Gestapo of limited alphabet. Wake up suspect. Splash of fist. Answer quick. Life or take away death. Looking well, Buck. Must be published of late. Fans willing to strip. Not ask embarrassing questions like, why so lame and limp, Charles? Buck chimp to resign. Grimace. Even in vacant basement. Demand of questions. Interfering with wise reception, angels, a patient listening, and poem.
Ah, Peter. I always know it's going to be fun coming from him. So I like, from the very beginning, the way that he points out that when people ask how you're doing, it's often not really a question. How are you doing? Looking well. Without a pause in between. So it's true. People just keep on talking, which usually saves me from having to answer because it's just something they say. It's not an actual question. And then to say it's better to be like Bukowski when you're at home, because in Happy Party Land, death and grief are banned. You're not really supposed to talk about things that he would want to talk about. Where is it now? There's a part about father in casket of non-cognition. So for me, that means the father has Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia where he feels like he's lost him. It's like he's died, but he hasn't actually died. He's in the non-cognition casket. And then St. Peter with idle ambition. So if I'm not mistaken, St. Peter's is the one who is said to be like the gates of heaven deciding who gets in. And so for St. Peter to be idle, it's like, well, you know, we could go get him now, but let's let him be there in his non-cognition. But also, the author is Peter. So I think that he is playing on his own name there. And then, where is it? When he's talking about the cows, I think he's actually also talking about women. He usually has something a little dirty in there. So he's thinking about the women and the milking-related body parts. Blackbirds for breakfast made me think about the expression eating crow, you know, humiliation by being proven wrong and having to admit that you were wrong. I feel like that's wrapped in there somewhere. And then there's something else I want to say at the end. I can't remember now. So it was interesting. It took some twists. Classic Peter Solway, you know, makes us think. It takes a couple of readings, I think, to make sure I catch everything that he's saying. And I like that about them. He's always a little bit layered and mysterious. What did you think?
I like the Bukowski example at the beginning, because the beat poets are the ones that just put it out there. So I thought that was a perfect figure to use, an example to use, that, you know, be Bukowski at home. And I felt like he has all these metaphors that you tease out that they're all these metaphors that he's building about, like, I think how it feels to say you're okay when you're not and such. Like, there's the one part about a deaf hearing doctor, I'm not too sure how it exactly phrased it, but there's that disconnect there that, you know, someone checking out your hearing, but they're deaf. And it feels to me like I would have to spend some time teasing out all of these metaphors, but it feels to me like the metaphors that he's used here are building upon a feeling or an idea of the disconnect when people are asking how you doing, and, you know, they're just doing it out of obligation, or you know, there's also the disconnect of how you feel and what you want to say. And the ending was good with angels of patient listening. I just thought of the people that, you know, they're a good listener, and you know, say, oh, thank you, you're an angel for listening to me, and, you know, and just, and not interrupting. That just came to my mind, that probably has nothing to do at all with what he was expressing here. But, you know, when you have people that are listening to you and they don't interrupt and they don't offer advice. Like they realize that you just need someone to listen to you. So that just kind of was a tangential thing that it reminded me of that.
I am all about tangents. I got to check in on Babbler. She's been away because she's ill for a very long time, and she's the queen of, like, awesome tangents. So it's good to have tangents. Now we have one by Ben Hart, and this is called A Leap of Faith. Ben Hart. How are you doing? Please don't ask me that. Why? Because I don't want to breathe a lie. 1. Love was my self-harm, and poetry was just me bleeding. 2. I fall in love with every stranger, but I am only chasing them for the shelter they provide. See, I need to build my dreams above the flood line. I cannot swim in my sleep. They are my driftwood. I cannot swim against the silence of the sheets on my skin. I think the cigarettes knew me best. I let them in, and they knew I was their killer, and I knew they were mine. Those rules made sense to me in a world passing me by. Echoes of death in the back of my throat. That is how my mind checked if the body was still alive, or if they had my funeral in the time I tried to light myself on fire. 3. In Shadows Abandoned. Was I the light? Were these not poems, but missing person posters? Where did everybody leave? When did everybody leave? And why has no one tried to find me? Is there no man behind the mask? Only thoughts behind storm's eyelids? And like the black fly in the hallway, I will die here, in this body of glass. Was it truth when they said the world would end with apricity? That tomorrow's dawn would be warmer than the primrose drip? Or was I right to let the breakers pull me in? Amen. 4. You said that you loved my work, calling it something to get lost in. But I should have felt sorry for you then to experience these elegies of us benumbed. At least a blind man gets to touch my words, travel its ripples and bow waves safely across the blank page between us, like birds on the power line singing the clouds apart to let light weave a bridge across its wounds. It escaped me how a trembling colliding with rainfall gave name to the architects and taught them the strongest shape in nature is that of a pregnant belly, a leap of faith. But we still spend our entire lives afraid of returning to that amniotic drifting. My love, if the stars are falling, it is not into some cold inexistence. They are only dandelions, souls shining, lifted back into the wind of time. And these words, all my loving effort, it was only my record of you taking flight. 5. You know how many times I lost the courage to even look at you. When you ask, tell me, poem boy, what is it you wish for? Afraid my eyes will betray the truth, that in whatever language, be they of different worlds or different words or different worlds, I wish someone will read this as though laying flowers by a monument of you. End poem. Can you comment first, please, Robbie?
Yes. Sorry, I just wait to know if I'm the first or the second. One of the things that caught me actually is a couple of times now in these poems they refer to poets specifically, or poems, poets, and I'm thinking that maybe what that is like. Like poets have a kind of a rep as like talking fancifully when they want to, or just kind of putting the wool over people's eyes, especially like, saying something without actually saying anything at all. And I'm thinking maybe that's why that's showing up in these poems, because, you know, we're talking about in all these poems about the connection or lack thereof, or like, you know, when you have to say something but mean something else, or like sometimes, you know, it's that matter of like saying something without revealing your hand too much, like, you know, like when you say you're fine, you're saying that because you don't really want to reveal what's going on. And the title of the poem caught me because it felt to me like it was really meant to frame the overall idea of this poem. And it's like with a leap of faith that I'm thinking they're talking about the leap of faith you can take when you actually do tell someone how you're doing. I'm not too sure if that's what was meant for that by that, but it does feel to me that regardless that the title there, Leap of Faith, is meant to be a significant framing for the poem.
I agree. I kind of took it that way too, that it is a leap of faith to open up and let people know how you really are doing. I agree with you there. I really liked the part about the cigarettes. I'm not a smoker, but I really love the way that he interpreted it here. And I knew I was their killer, and I knew they were mine. And they knew I was their killer, and I knew they were mine. It's like this kind of mutual destruction relationship with the cigarettes, having a psychological battle of a slow suicide, but you destroy them as they destroy you. I kind of like that concept. I feel like I have that relationship with food. that is how my mind checked if the body was still alive. I really like that part. I relate to that. So it's like the echoes of death in the back of my throat. That what I have a negative association with, because I just don't like smoking. To me, it's a gross feeling at the back of your throat. But maybe it's not for everyone. Maybe it's enjoyable. But for me, having pain is sometimes how I know that I'm alive. Remember when I first got my brain tumor pain better? I thought I died, because when I woke up, my head didn't hurt. And usually, knowing I was, like, as soon as I was awake, my head hurt. That was, like, how I knew I was awake. So when I woke up and my head didn't hurt, I thought I died. sometimes you have something that is recognition of being alive that is not a great thing. And I kind of like that as a description of the connection with cigarettes. Where is it? To have the poem
honest connection. As I was going to say before I forgot, it's a very honest relationship too. Like with the cigarettes, like even though you know it's killing you, you know where you're at with that habit or with those cigarettes. And it's like, even though it's not good, it's honest, as opposed to what is being compared to in the poems. In the poem here?
Yes. I like that. That's a good point. It's an honest relationship. And sometimes you're attracted to things that you know are bad, or even people that you know are bad, because at least you know, the devil you know, rather than the one who seems nice and ends up being devilish. I really like the idea of poems as missing person posters, because, like, to write about how lost you feel and to maybe show how you really are, because I think a lot of people use all poetry for that. It's like screaming out into the void, but actually having people respond back. So to have it and then wonder why no one has tried to find him, like, it, but except that's not true, Ben, because you have people who follow you. I follow you, and like follow him online, not like stalk him, follow him. I'm going to Europe. The wanting people to know you, how you are for real, but also not wanting them to know is really tough. Where is it? There was a part in the next section that I wanted to quote. I liked the birds on the power lines singing the clouds apart. Just singing the clouds apart is a really cool line.
I'm planning this contest is bringing out especially unique similes and images and allegories in that. Like, this is more than any contest I've come across thus far. Like, all of these poems, a lot of them are kind of in section two. Like, you have section one, section two, section three, or letters or something. And, yeah, the imagery is just so... Not quite esoteric, but just unique, and it's more than other poems I've read. It's in other contests. It's like, you know, someone saying, you know, the sky was like a dove's wings opening up, or something like that. And you're like, oh, that's what a unique image. I wonder what they mean by that. And that's one thing I'm enjoying about the poems in this contest that we've been reading so far.
I've been really lucky where I get amazing poems like that in most of my contests, although I like to pretend that I just have prompts that bring that out of people.
I'd roll with
I'm
going
to put
too.
You to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, go with it. I think I just draw it out of people. I'm going to take a small amount of credit in there, even though I didn't write the poem that is the prompt or the poems inspired by it, but I'm the go-between that will serve as, like, the shell of the muse who will present them with things. That's how I'm going to play my role. I'm putting you to work, Robbie. You got to read the next poem, please.
Yep. Okay. Let me just refresh here. Okay. How am I today? Let me just scroll down. How am I today? If more social, I would sit you down, stroke your little dog, and regale you with my first hours of this fine day. But I'm not social or regaling. How am I? Uncomfortable within. Angry with myself for not being more social or wanting to pet your dog. Have frequently wondered if I would be happier in a world of more of you, so you could ask each other, how are you? Bypassing me completely, or none of you, as so being asocial would not in any way be guilt-laden. How am I? End poem.
I really enjoy this. I'm in this Facebook group called Tell Me You're Neurodivergent Without Saying You're Neurodivergent. And this has that kind of feel to it. And I mean that in a loving way, Tempest 5, please don't be offended by that. I'm in the group because I am not neurotypical. I feel like there's this recognition that, how from an outside perspective, this is how a social person would react, but that's not me. Wondering, you know, the different alternatives. I really like that it wonders, what would it be like with, if there were more social people, so you could just leave them to themselves, what would it be if there just weren't people, so you didn't have to be social. I like the questions there. I like that it's using questions. It has like a kind of philosophicalness to it. Not only is it the question of how am I, it's questioning what would be the best solution to that situation. I also really find it interesting how it's not just one thing that they're avoiding, you know, not just the human, but also the dog. Where personally, I would be like distracting myself with the dog, because if I don't know how to deal with the person, then I'm just like petting the dog and focused on the dog, and I'm just like, you know, this is a way for me to interact without having to answer the question. But I like how direct this is. It's like, but then it also is the anger at yourself for not knowing how to respond. And I think that's also kind of, well, I was going to say normal, but I am not normal, so I don't know if it's actually normal. That feeling of, like, feeling like you're kind of alien and not knowing how to respond. Because sometimes when people ask me something like, how are you? I have this, like, thing. It's like, answer like a human. Be a normal person and respond. And my brain's just like, do-do-do. There's no real response. And I'm like, damn you for not being human, to myself. Because I'm crazy like that. But I felt like I connected to this poem. Like I felt seen that someone else has these doubts.
Well, I felt connected to this poem, too. Yeah. Because this really actually this, like, you know, sometimes a poem just comes up like a firework in your brain. And this one did for me, because it's not quite the same, but it's a parallel where, it was talking about, well, do I want to be around people that are sociable or not? Do I want to be myself sociable or not? And I'm really struggling with that right now, actually, because I'm finding that, especially post-COVID, like people are still, a lot of times people are still really jerky. That hasn't really seemed to, like, I see, you know, when I Google it, I see articles like the Vice. It says, you know, how come, why are people still, you know, like so jerky? And I've really struggled these days because I myself am naturally a more social person. I like being around people. I like talking to people. Although I definitely like, I know when I need and want my own alone time. But then what I'm coming across is that there's less and less people that I feel like I want to be sociable with. It's just, yeah, there's just more and more jerky people around these days, it seems. And so I vibed with that in this poem, that struggle of like, okay, well, where is my ideal here? Do I want to be more sociable or not? And it's a strong disconnect when you feel like you want to be sociable, but there are less people to be sociable with. And you're just like, oh. You just like get that exasperated sigh in your brain.
I think because I'm an introvert who kind of forces myself into extrovert roles, I actually found the COVID times to be a little bit like illuminating to myself of like, I don't need to be around people as much as I was. Like, it was like, I was okay being isolated. I actually kind of liked it to a certain degree. So now I'm like, I think pickier about who I want to hang out with, because I'm like, I don't need to just force myself to be with people for the sake of being with people. I'll be with people who I connect with. So I know what you mean. There's kind of like, I'm one of those people who like never stopped being a bitch after COVID. So probably like the problem you're seeing.
Well, I feel that way inside. I feel that way inside a little bit too. I feel just I feel more short about certain things, especially like there's some very specific things. It's like, oh, I just don't have the patience for this anymore. Like when people get on the bus and they're like the same people and they like they never have change, you know? And it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot my transfer. I forgot my change. And it's, you know, the same person each time. And you know that they're just trying to get on the bus for free and that. And those little things like that, they just, I don't have any patience for it anymore. I just don't. Yeah, that exasperated. Yeah, we're both thinking that right now. Yeah. Great minds think alike, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
This poem is called "How Are You?" and it's by Jitte. Been knocking on death's door before, blinded by scars that are cut deep, hiding behind a wall filled with pain, breathing with a world full of regret. Looking in the mirror, nothing appears, letting my emotions take hold of me, withdrawn from those trying to help, feeling challenged by my lack of control. Struggling to get a hold of my thoughts, crawling out of a state of depression, finding out how to survive in this life, leaving the constant battle with myself. End poem. How about when I read the poem, you comment first?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm used to there being more like three or four people or whatever. So with this, there's more of the emphasis on phones far away from me, the internal as opposed to the external. All the poems have focused on that to a certain degree, but this one is especially focused on the internal thoughts, and the self-reflection, like looking in the mirror, nothing appears. Letting my emotions take hold of me. So in this poem, the person's really focused on thinking about their inner landscape and how things make them feel. Like it says, withdrawn from those trying to help, feeling challenged by my lack of control. And I like that looking in the mirror part. Looking in the mirror, nothing appears. And so it's kind of like this, you know, you're looking at yourself. It's almost like you're looking at a void. You're looking at yourself, but you're not really seeing anything. And of course, and it actually, I think it's because of that, that the emotions take control of you, because it's kind of like there's nothing to, it's just the emotions. There's nothing else going on. So you just, when you feel the emotions, they just come right in.
This is cool, because I think rather than it being an external force who's asking how she is, it's her asking herself and not being willing to face it or not wanting to face it. She's looking in the mirror wondering how she is and doesn't know how to respond. Now, I know from her other poems that Jitte has been through a lot and is paralyzed, and when she talks about being knocking on death's door, she did have near-death experiences. So I imagine, and I don't know this, that her appearance probably has changed because of that accident, or like close to the accident, she definitely would have had wounds. And when you look in the mirror and you're trying to like assess how you are, not only is there the physical difference that you see, but it reflects the difference of the way your life maybe from then on. And also it shows, you know, you can't look at yourself and know that you're going to get out of this state of depression. Sometimes you look at yourself in the eyes in the mirror and you can see how sad you are, and then you're like, shit, people can see that. Like, even if you're otherwise having a good reflection day, which do I ever? But if you're looking good, but you recognize in yourself that you can see that there's an emotion there that you were trying to kind of mask, then that's one thing. But also, if you look in the mirror and nothing's there, if the face is blank and emotionless, then that kind of reminds you of numbness, and that you have to deal with that. And it's a constant battle with myself, that she says at the end. And that battle being the, am I going to be okay? Am I going to choose to be okay? Am I going to do whatever I need to be okay? I just really like that she's asking the question herself, and the mirror part works well. Thank you for sharing, Jay Tay. I never know how to say people's usernames. It is a challenge at times. Okay, so I'm going to give...
Be thankful you don't have my last name. Everyone always... It has a silent J, and everyone always gets it wrong, and it's infuriating. Okay. So I'm just going to this. Okay. So here we go. My turn to read, correct?
Yes.
Answering about and asking how I'm doing. Age raised, so at my old age, at morning, hour, daily prayers. Almighty Lord, give me liberty. Also provide peace for society. All animals, human beings, trees, always live happily. Without cries, anger, agony, anxiety, ego, desire, avoiding these all to get pleasure. Absolute truth on earth is truth, all should realize fame's worth. As a poet at AP, I am fortunate, after my death voice of heart, available on earth's soil forever, answer flows from heart's core. At last, salute goes for Almighty, also for poets who write poetry and poem.
Great read. Thank you, Robbie. This is very straightforward. You know, it's to the point. It has kind of an easy vocabulary, but there's a formality to it. Lots of words with A, so it's got like an alliteration thing going, but anger, agony, anxiety, and every line starts with an A, which is like an overwhelming amount of A's now that I'm looking at it. So a lot of A's. And interesting that truth is capitalized, although so is Almighty, so maybe it's thinking of truth in a religious sense. What did you think?
Well, the part that got me with the most attention was anger, agony, anxiety, ego, desire, avoiding all these to get pleasure. And it's kind of that idea of like that, what is the sense of self, and kind of like how all these things, well, like it mentions ego itself, but like anger, agony, anxiety, especially desire, that's very much part of ego. And that's often what does get in the way of pleasure. And I see here, like, yeah, you were saying the truth. Like, there's actually a small t before that big T. Like, absolute truth has a small t, but then it has the big T, truth, like in the sentence after. So to me, that kind of points to the same direction, I think, that you're pointing towards, because there's that differentiation between, small truth and big truth. And the poem touches upon what we were talking about, or you were mostly talking about, just talking into the void in that, but, you're here at All Poetry, and you're putting yourself out into the world, and people are receiving you. And she expresses that here, saying, as a poet at AP, I am fortunate after my voice death of heart. That's a really impactful line there. That it's talking about how, part of her, her heart had died. And it's just kind of like the voice of her emotions. It's like she didn't really feel anymore. She felt like, more so that, but maybe secondarily, that she didn't have anywhere to put her voice, but now she has somewhere to put that. And so her, to my mind, her heart is more alive again, the voice of her heart.
That's a good interpretation. Although I'm pretty sure he's a man, but I like that interpretation of the poem. That's okay. It's like with usernames and stuff, it's really tough to know sometimes. I'm going entirely off of the
writing
picture.
Poem, and I barely look at the right side. I just get laser focused on the poem, and then I realize afterwards, wait a minute.
I mean, gender doesn't necessarily matter, so it's all good. Our next poet is Stephen T. Wellman, and this is called Layers. Break the skin, let others in. We slightly forget to peel the many layers and kill the players. We keep the masks, and when someone asks, how are you? We deceivingly say, I'm okay.
Oh, well, this poem has a kind of a metaphor of a game. It feels like it says to peel the many layers and kill the players. And so it's kind of in a short space there, it seems to be reflecting the idea of the whole kind of give and take of a conversation as a sort of a game. And I'm just thinking about break the skin, let others in. And then this is first stanza here. I'm just curious about to peel the many layers and kill the players. That one caught my eye just for making me ponder the exact direction of that expression there. So we slightly forget to peel the layers and kill the players. I'm wondering if maybe players he means kind of like when you say, oh, he's just a player or she's just a player, and kind of relating that to people that aren't really being genuine.
Yeah, that's kind of how I took it. And I think it's also about the games that people play of pretending to be someone that they're not. There's not necessarily in an identity switch kind of way, but playing games, trying to seem better than you are, or manipulating things and pretending to be friends with just the whole frenemy thing. It's all the drama that I have no patience for. I think he's saying if you get rid of those layers, then you get rid of the people who are are only interested in those layers.
I know as
I'm
older.
Sorry,
I
interrupted
older,
you. I just kind of was off on a thing. Continue.
No, I was going to say very briefly that as I get older, I have no time for the frenemies thing. If a friend is really an enemy, then there's just no point, right? I actually find it to be an odd kind of an idea now. They talk crap about me and they do this and that, but I'm still their friend. And I just, now as a, especially over the last like maybe 3 years. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't jive with me. it just seems like such a exhaustive waste of mental resources.
Yes, and this is partly why I was never very popular, because I just refused to play those games. It's like, either you're nice to me or you're not. I don't put up with the bullshit. Our next poem, you get the pleasure of reading one by Daniel DeShino.
Ah, here we go. Should be fun. A bluish yellow crayon with a summer forest paint by Number Kit. A melting butter sculpture carved with rusty chainsaw laughter. So goes time against me. How am I? Who am I? Sometimes where am I? Most of the time, how did I get here? Wait a second. Ask me again. Then ask me again. Wait. Hold on. Okay. Ask me again now. Confused? How do you think I feel? How am I doing today? I'm bluish yellow. No, not green. Bluish yellow. Look it up. That's how I'm doing. How do I feel? Some days like a cross between 100-headed hydra, a millipede, and a myriad branching lightning bolt. I feel everything all at once. Other days, like a bodiless entity of pure imagination, forgotten in a dead man's dream. But most of the days, I just feel like whatever happens to touch my skin. What choice do I have? Whatever touches me, I feel it. Touchy thing to nerve to brain. And then it is felt. Nothing I can do about it. The more days on this earth, the more my mind feels like a Ferris wheel, kaleidoscope, flea market maze. The more I open my eyes, the more I hear the sound whoosh. The more I listen, the more all the noise, which masquerades as everything, comes into the light. And I see it. I really have no idea who I am. And I am much, much too tired to figure out how I feel. Or were you just looking for me to say, I'm fine. How are you doing? And poem.
Excellent read and excellent poem. This again, asks questions. Wondering not just how he is, but who he is. And those kind of go together sometimes. I like that he makes it like the crayons are mixed up. And no, it's not a green of a perfectly mixed up blue and yellow. It's something else, something in between. The way that he describes feeling with like all of the heads and the legs, and especially the myriad branching lightning bolts. Oh, I love that part. Just imagining the way that it goes like in all directions and you just feel overwhelmed by it. I strongly connected to where he says, I feel everything all at once, but other days, a bodiless entity of pure imagination. I always thought this was just because of my brain damage stuff, but sometimes I feel sensory overload over every little thing. It's like I can feel how many fibers are in my socks. And everything is so overwhelming. And in other days, it's like I don't feel anything at all. I'm like not even in a body. I'm just there. I strongly connect with the bold, like, feel all the things or feel nothing sense there. And very cool that that people feel that. I also like it where he talks about the noise masquerades as everything. So the more I listen, the more all the noise which masquerades as everything comes to the light and I see it. It's like everything seems to pretend to be something. But also it feels like there's so much going on because there's all the noise of the busyness and the everything is at once, but then there's nothing actually happening of significance sometimes. So it's like everything and nothing. I like at the end the kind of honesty of, like, I don't know who I am. And I don't know how I feel. Because sometimes you just don't. And the very last line is really the I think, ongoing theme for a lot of the poems is recognizing that the person who asks probably doesn't want the real answer. I really enjoyed this. You got to read it, Robbie. Do you want to comment, too?
This especially has an emphasis on, it's like the idea that he's trying to figure himself out, and so he has, like, an impatience or frustration at the, like, when someone's asking him, how are you doing, he's singing to himself, well, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how I'm doing or who I really am in that. And I'm not really in the mood to say, well, how I'm doing, because I haven't figured all these things out yet. And especially in the last part here, it says, I'm fine. How are you doing? And that really caught my attention, because not only is it, like you were saying, like in many other poems where they don't want the real answer, but it's in here that there's also an expectation of the person's hoping that they ask them the same thing. Well, how are you doing? You know? And a lot of times when the funny thing is, again, this is one of those tangents. It's like, you know, if you're in a conversation and, you know, it's, oh, I'm fine. How are you doing? Oh, I'm fine. How are you doing? Oh, well, you know, Jenny was talking about my boyfriend again and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, God. Oh, God, I just got pulled in again, didn't I? You know? And it's just, you know, there are some times where there's those people you know that if you ask, you know, if you reciprocate and you say, well, how are you doing? You're going to be like, oh, God, I'm going to regret this, aren't I? You just don't want to do it.
Yes, because I, as much as I do care, there are some people who, like, will take up the entire day. So I'm not someone who asks it emptily. I ask it if I can legitimately have time and the emotional energy to respond properly. But, like, I have this one person who I supervise who, if you ask her how she is, she will literally talk for 4 hours if you don't interrupt her. Like, the whole day is gone. The entire day, nothing will get done whatsoever. There's no, like, boundary of stopping. And it's like, let's do this, like, as our 15-minute break, not the entire day. And I always feel like the bitch interrupting and, like, trying to get her to focus on her work, because she has a lot of big things going on. So it makes sense that she, like, needs to talk, but also not be, like, entire day, literally. Like, I'm not just, like, using hyperbole there. So I'm the bitch who doesn't ask, because I only ask things if I am really prepared for the real answer. Our next poem is by Oshimi Creations, and it's called How Am I Doing? Answering the question, how am I doing, is like a complex algebra exam in which I lack the necessary tools to ensure I'm successful. Answering the question, how am I doing, takes me on a journey in which my feeble attempts at explaining my emotions shape my listeners into cleverly crafted, confounded masterpieces. So I don't. Instead, when people ask me how I'm doing, I run away, like a slave who's hungry to taste the joys of freedom. When people ask me how I'm doing, I hide, like an abused child, chained by crippling hands of fear. When people ask me how I'm doing, my brain proceeds to paint a portrait that not even I can understand. So when people ask me how I'm doing, I look at them and I will simply say, nothing. End poem.
Well, that goes even more in the direction of, it's not even like where you're don't want to give an obligatory response, or you just give a very obligatory response, you just do nothing. He's like, he can't even be bothered to respond, eh? Because it's just that frustrating. And the thing in this one is, it kind of goes upon the theme again of, as someone who's studying math and has studied math for a while, I especially appreciated the complex algebra exam analogy. And again, it's kind of like in the previous poem where your internal landscape is so complicated at the time that, you know, with you trying to figure it out, you really don't feel like trying to verbalize that to somebody, because you're trying to verbalize it to yourself still, right? So there's kind of that continuation, or that sort of theme coming up again. And you feel kind of the angst of, well, where it says answering the question, how am I doing? It's kind of that internal thing of, it's saying the feeble attempts at explaining my emotions. And I shape my listeners into cleverly crafted, confounded masterpieces. So, it sounds here like they have a doubt that if they really explained how they feel, that the person would understand. And so that creates an anxiety and an angst in their mind when they're thinking of how they're going to craft their answer and what they want to say. So they just don't.
Yes. I really liked this one. When it says it's like a complex algebra exam, it makes me think there's this meme that's Katie Sackhoff, the actress, in her role as Starbuck on Battlestar Galactica, I think. And she's trying to do a math equation in the picture, and she looks like all like confuzzled, and it usually like says something ridiculous. But there's one that says, I'm smart enough to know I'm awkward, but I'm not smart enough to know how to not be awkward, or something like that. And when it's talking about it being like an algebra thing, and it just reminded me of that, where she has that expression in that picture of like, oh, like, how am I supposed to answer this? I really like the way that it's put here with, I lack the necessary tools to ensure I'm successful. And, sometimes we lack the tools to express ourselves, even as poets. I really loved the line, cleverly crafted, confounded masterpieces, partly because of the alliteration of it, but also just the idea of a masterpiece being so, the fact that it is a masterpiece means it is well-crafted. It probably is clever and complicated. So that all works really well together. That's brought in again at the end. My brain proceeds to paint a portrait that not even I can understand. And it's so complicated that how could you possibly express that? I think she did a wonderful job with this. She had a creative way of expressing it, as much as she's saying that it's hard to say what she's feeling. I feel like she did in this, and so it's just wonderful. Thank you, Oshini, for sharing.
It reminded me randomly of my I did this one math question one time, and it took like multiple steps, and it was like a really difficult question. And sometimes when you have these difficult questions, you expect this profound, you know, or like obtuse looking answer or whatever. But the answer turned out, and I always joke with my teacher about this. The answer turned out to be 1/3. And it was a little disappointing to me. It was like, I thought it was going to be like 3.25 to the second power or something, but no, just 1/3. I think there's a metaphor in there somewhere, you know, where like you're trying to figure yourself out. You're trying to figure out the answer to somebody or whatever, and you're expecting this profound thing, and then you just come out with, so how do you feel today? Shitty. You know, and that's all that comes out.
Yeah. I can't remember where it's an expression, but I keep seeing this thing where it's like, for some reason I think it's Norway, but it's not. I don't know, somewhere it's where in the common response to how are you is I'm standing and not crying. And that's like you don't have to say good. If you say good, great. But if you're, you know, just functioning and not wonderful but not terrible, you say standing and not crying. And I feel like that's an answer that I could give. I want that to be acceptable here, too. We are now on to our next contest. So this contest was based on a quote from On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, and it's by Ocean Vuong. "You're not a monster," I said, "but I lied. What I really wanted to say was that a monster is not such a terrible thing to be. From the Latin root monstrum, a divine messenger or catastrophe, then adapted by the old French to mean an animal of a myriad of origins, like a centaur, griffin, satyr, to be a monster is to be a hybrid signal, a lighthouse, both shelter and a warning at once." So that was the prompt. And our first entry here is by Peter Solway. And Robbie, you did a great job at reading Peter's last one, so I'm going to put you on this one as well.
Okay. Show you me lighthouse. Pretty shipwrecked lass, shivering in wet diaphanous dress. There you go, up them spiral steps, lantern in front, one by one. That's a good pet. Keep her with hardcore hunger after rape and murder, sitting down with Tom, canned sardines for dinner, confessing squealing girl best thrown from tower. Would have squealed some more, moaning about this love machine, only polishing her lens, saving a seaman having to explain. Our sad ending in the wings, Tom, me in prison. Young lads, a disappointment. You, dear, a lone man's companion, the heartless vets, balls to lose. They'll say in the human times, a monster worse than Hitler, oh, shallow historians, his non-kosher shepherds, tis bust, Blondie and Deborah, not straining at final leash, solution of fascist good times. Marlene on the gramophone, gulls with unkosher appetite, screaming like erect Wagner, fuck God, Nietzsche walking out. Oh, fates of future incarceration, cocktails no more on Salvation Stone. My poor neuter Tom, adopted by cruel Jews and house rules, locked out at night with naught to do but weather succumb. Lick wounds, maybe. Plot authentic revenge. Reduced to shifting on stoop. Proud Aryan poop. Last of our kind, soiling the airwaves, Tom. More sardines. A drop of virgin wine. End poem.
Excellent read. Although you turn the swears into not swears, so that was kind of with shitting. You said shifting. I was like, are you afraid to say shitting?
I don't know. I was really struggling with I thought one of the words was like kosher. Is that the word? Is that the spelling for kosher? Yeah.
No,
so I
no, I no. That I actually don't know how to say that one. I really liked some of the vocabulary in here though, like diaphanous. I thought that was the perfect word choice to create the mental image of the woman at the beginning, shivering in wet diaphanous dress. You can just picture the way that it's like see-through in the water, and the, because it's a pretty shipwreck lass crawling up on the rocks. It's very vivid in my mind what she would look like there. Oh fates of future incarceration, cocktails no more on salvation stone. I really like that. Future incarceration. It's like, oh, I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I'm going to do it anyway. The future incarceration. Cocktails no more on salvation stone. Just really clever way of wording things. Which is typical of Peter. I like the I can never say his name either. Nietzsche? That, you know who I mean?
Yeah, I think
where
it's
it says, fuck God, Nietzsche walking out. I liked that reference there. I actually don't know which women he's referring to with, like, Marlene and the Blondie and Deborah. I'm sure those are specific historical figures, because he's pretty good at throwing in some history and art lessons into his poems, but I actually don't know who those ones are, and I have not looked it up. Do you off the top of your head know?
No, not off the top of my head. I was kind of wondering myself.
All right, Peter, if you're listening, we want to know who these women are. What were your thoughts?
This one had a real bite to it. It felt like there was a lot of subversion, it's hard for me to kind of verbalize it, but it felt like he was really biting at what people usually think, or kind of like the conventional thinking, and like in the beginning, where it says, it ends off with, that's a good pet. And it kind of almost felt like a bite at the whole, like, you know, the maiden in the tower, you know, the fragile maiden in the tower. I could be completely misreading that. I have a feeling perhaps I am. But it's especially like in the stanza that starts with, they'll say in human times. And that one's like, just seems to especially be really going after all the perceptions that people have. And I appreciated the Nietzsche reference, because I've always found Nietzsche to be a fascinating philosopher. And it was kind of interesting to see Wagner and then Nietzsche walking out, because Nietzsche is famous for talking about how, you know, like, God's dead and we killed him, kind of like we've killed the idea of God. So I was kind of surprised that Nietzsche is walking out, because I would think that would be like kind of the opposite. So yeah, I'm not 100% sure what's going on there. And then yeah, the at the end with the reduced to shifting on stoop. Again, like kind of the subversion, or it's just this idea that, you know, you've been reduced to sitting on a stoop, proud Aryan poop. So yeah, the whole thing overall to me has that feeling of something that has a real bite to it. And he's the things that he's not liking and not, yeah, he's just really going after with absolutely no what was I going to say? Like, absolutely no...
Yeah, I don't believe Peter has a filter. But I like that about him.
No. I remember Mike Ford, Dan Fielding, he had said something really, like, you know, racy or whatever, and Christine's like, oh, I can't believe you said that. He says, oh, I have a, see, no filter. And she says, oh, you have a filter, you just don't want to use it. That's so hilarious. I love Dan Fielding, I just love them. See, no filter.
The next poem is by Ben Hart, and this is called Skinny. Monsters in the wardrobe, trying on our clothes. Skinny ghosts wishing for their bones back. Yellow smoke, distress flares, tracer rounds, and jellyfish flack. Going down again, brace for impact. Here comes the bottom of my last beer can. Here comes the words. One. Milk and soap. Cinnamon was to winter what nicotine was to a drunk. A sweet euthanasia. But all I tasted on your lips was the word run. Honey and wet wood smoke, a beekeeper's warning that the hive had fallen and you were the queen now, playing a cold welcome as a warm farewell. Starlight song in the silence bound. Two. Home. On a railroad red eye, golden arboretums marked the distance between me and my tin roof hotel room, and I watched them take off, a rocket launch, with glass jet plane escorts shattering on regolith veils, buttercup chandeliers, for the rocket man to swing from the teenage runaway, not returning from the rungspringa. Asteroid stepping stones carry them across the deep black river time, saying, see you on the other side, to every weightless footstep in the dust, cradling the angels lost behind closed eyes, failing to paint dead halos gold again. Three, Imogene. Arboreal child of cartilage and creatine, I've built you a nest in mother's canopy, from twigs, feathers, opaque gemstones, my breath, my warmth, and my broken bones. Fight for the privilege of youth. Nobody ever got anywhere on gratitude alone. So march barefoot in the autumn dew to make yourself a home in the unknown. Let the norns weave you wings of paper thread to fly to the new horizons, born from flightless poet wildfires. Go dance the lies from the lips of the candied sapphire, singing the lights out in your head. Because every phoenix is a ronin, now that the space whales are dead. When all the fields that kept their bellies fed turned to gold upon moonlight overthrowing them. My Abigail Fury, your wilder mind, do not lose it. Shadows are the only light's memories of you. A ruby girl, shadows are only the light's memories of you. A ruby girl dreaming she is blue. It does not wound me, daughter, that you grew higher from tattooed roots. It healed me to hear you screaming, none of it was beautiful, because Papa did not raise a mute. End poem.
Oh, I just saw the author's, well, I don't know if it was the author's note or it was part of the prompt, but it says, for the people I hope never fail. Never to fail. And that's the feeling I got, because especially the, like, you see how this poem, again, like a lot of the other ones were put into different parts. And with the third part, you really feel the emphasis of a personal journey. And it interested me to see it, like, towards the end. It does not wound me, daughter, that you grew higher from tattooed roots. And I was thinking what tattooed roots was referring to. I'm thinking kind of like from humble beginnings, that sort of thing. And it healed me to hear be screaming. None of it was beautiful because Papa did not raise a mute. So the idea that they're going to express their own truth, they're not going to hold that back. And before I continue on, could you just refresh me on, like, so this was the, this was to another prompt that you had, and the prompt, it had, were you saying something about a minotaur in it, or I heard some of it, but I didn't quite catch all of it.
Yeah, sure. I'll say the prompt again. So the prompt is, you're not a monster, but I want to say, but I lied. What I really wanted to say was that the monster is being that, sorry, a monster is not such a terrible thing. From the Latin root, monstrum, a divine messenger of catastrophe, then adapted by the old French to mean an animal of a myriad origins, centaur, griffin, satyr. To be a monster is to be a hybrid signal, a lighthouse, both shelter and warning at once.
Oh, okay, so it's kind of the idea of, like, what it means to be a monster or not, and, okay, yeah. So it's interesting to hear monstrum because, and the meaning of that, because there's a one YouTube channel that used to be called Monstrum that had all the mythologies and all that. In this also, there's, as with so many of our poems tonight, even though this is a different prompt than from the beginning of the show, it's such unique imagery. I love the cinnamon was to winter what nicotine was to a drunk, and there's kind of like intertwining of the sweetness and bitterness. Like a sweet euthanasia. I mean, that's the ultimate entwining of sweet and bitter. And there's somewhere along here a image of a space whale, I think it was, or something along those lines. And this is one of those poems where I could really pick apart some of the singular images that she has in here. I love asteroid stepping stones, carry them across the deep black river of time. I just love that. And just on the image alone, it's just a very beautiful and impactful image.
It really is. There's a few places like that in this poem. Where is it? There's the beginning of one of the sections. Child of cartilage and creatine, I've built you a nest in mother's canopy from twigs, feathers, and opaque gemstones. My breath, my warmth, and my broken bones. The idea of giving your own bones and warmth and breath to the nest is fascinating, and just like you're putting yourself into that protection of that child. That's beautiful and shocking at the same time. But my favorite part in the poem was, let the norns weave you wings of paper thread to fly to new horizons, born from flightless poet wildfires. Go dance the lies from lips of candied sapphire, singing the light out in your head. I mean, that is so gorgeous. I actually said to him, I'm like, if I was planning on having a gravestone, which I'm probably not because I think I'm just going to be cremated, but I would want that on it. There's something about that. I love it so much.
Maybe just get a really big urn. Have that etched on the urn.
I don't want to take up space in the world. I'm just
me neither. I'm so glad to hear someone else say that. I hate that idea. Like, it's, when I'm gone, I'm gonna be gone. You know, and I mean, I have my own beliefs on, you know, how if I'll just be like literally recycled into the universe, or there's a spirit of me out there and all that, but on that like that literal physical space, that plane, I don't want my body to be taken up space after I die. No, yeah, that doesn't jive with me.
Me either. I feel like the whole world's just going to be graveyards if we giving human-shaped things to everywhere. But you know what?
Yeah.
As much as I say that for my own body, I like having somewhere where I can associate mourning with people. So I understand the urge to have graveyards, but I don't want to take up space.
Talking about tangents, right?
Right? You can use this as my will. If I die before I have a proper will, use this recording as my, like, she doesn't want a grave.
Yeah.
Use this recording. All right. Our next poem is by Daniel DeShino.
Okay. Okay, yes, my turn to read it. Yeah. Conflict. A beacon of effervescent kaleidoscope confusion. Those that find the light, the beacon in a foggy night, hypnotized by the allure, the silent siren smiling, a flash of hope and fright. And what of the forgotten lighthouse keeper? Oh, how blinding it is inside the lighthouse itself. Who am I, or what am I? The lighthouse keeper, or the lighthouse? How is the one controlling the light, not both? I mean, I think, so at least some of me somewhere is not just the lighthouse. Rational is a swarm of bees dealing with a post-hibernation brown bear feet. Logical is the rule of a prison yard. Intelligence is a shark tasting a surfboard. I think I'm doing it right now, and I know things, whether they're the truth or not. Then why does the monster, that lighthouse that wants to learn things but also craves them, so often take over? That instinctual animal that is me, but it's not, but it is. When does a lioness, a mother of her own, lying peaceful in a clear sky, gray grassland day, head up enjoying the breeze? When does motherhood turn to hunting the weakest of the children? I want only to breathe, but the monster also breathes. And when it breathes out, it is a roar of consumption. We are all hunters, and that monster named desire, want, need, kidnaps thought and reason. And all the rocks that hold up the lighthouse, the foundation, become as a Tasmanian devil pack feeding frenzy. Where is humanity in the monster manual? Who chronicles the battle of the cellular survival monster machine and the abstract thinking being? Like-minded lovers live in peace when men and monster eventually clash, evolution's bane. Then does harmony cease? Let your monster be free with the monster in me, and together the beast can bond and consume. And all how happy the monsters will be. And let the loving and rational of us find each other, for when beast and thought mix, both will find doom. End poem. And,
excellent read.
Thanks. Yeah, I put myself on mute there for a second, then I realized, wait a minute, I'm commenting. I can't put myself on mute while I comment. there was a kind of a an idea I got of it's a philosophy called solipsism, where they say the only thing you can be sure of is your own existence. So it's like you can't be sure of anyone else's existence, but you can be sure of your own. And I really like the symbol of the lighthouse overall, and I have a fascination with lighthouses, so it's been fun and interesting to see lighthouses in these poems and how they're used. And I like that he's talking about the lighthouse being, which part it is. Yes, the lighthouse keeper or the lighthouse. How is the one controlling the light, not both? So it's kind of like you're the passenger, but the person who's steering your destiny at the same time, sort of. And I was kind of interested in this image here. Rational is a swarm of bees with a post-hibernation brown bear feet. That was one of those ones, again, that got me pondering, okay, what's the image here? And I was kind of thinking about, like, when you're like a swarm of bees is kind of like a collective intelligence thing. So it's like talking about what is rational, and it's kind of like your thoughts are being collected. So that's kind of what I got out of that part there. And I really like let the loving and rational of us find each other, for when the beast and thought mix, both will find doom. And I get the feeling of when, like, the two of them don't really mix, you know, like, you have your irrational thoughts that save you. Well, not your, or I was going to say your survival instinct, that sort of thing. You know, when they talk about, like, you know, the reptilian brain, that sort of thing, is that it's like the survival mode in that. And then you have pure thought, you have like logic, and those two just do not mix. They're like two completely separate entities.
That was a great comment. Yeah, I think you see a lot of what's in here. I like your insights. I also like the lighthouse part. And actually, the contest that I'm working on right now, which is inspired by Neil Gaiman and the Foreplay Quartet, String Quartet, album, which is spoken word poetry over classical music, there's one called The Wreckers. And in The Wreckers, it has, it talks about the people who were the wreckers, who would pretend that they were lighthouses, have all their lanterns there, so the ships would come that direction as if it was the lighthouse, and they would crash, and all their cargo would fall out, and then they would steal it. So it was an old pirating kind of trick of pretending to be the lighthouse. So that was just a small part of one of the poems that Neil Gaiman did. I'm going to use his album quotes, but just talking about the lighthouse in this one, I'm realizing, like, apparently that's a thing that I like, because it's also in my next contest. And I didn't make that connection until you pointed that out.
I'm definitely going to have to check out that contest. I love Neil Gaiman, and it just all sounds really interesting. And yeah, I'm definitely going to have to check that out. And, I was thinking to myself, it's amazing to me, human inventiveness for being like cruel to each other. It's just amazing how, you know, I would have never thought, oh, lighthouse. Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll pretend to be a lighthouse, and then I can pirate people. It's just amazing to me how people's brains will think that way. That, like, I remember an article I saw, something like this one just savage, I can't remember if he was a general or such, but he got pitch on fire, and then he would like nail it to the crows, and the crows would be like trying to get away from the pitch, and they'd fly off, and they'd land on the roofs trying to get the pitch away. I think it was pitch, and then the roofs would be set on fire, and I thought, oh my God, like, what kind of mentality even thinks of that? Like, you literally, 99.9% of people on the planet, you literally could not think of that. Like, your brain could not even go to that place, right? So it just amazes me. Like I say, you know, like the whole, oh, let's be a lighthouse machine. A lighthouse machine. I don't know why it's a machine. Let's be a lighthouse so we can steal from people. It's just amazing.
I know. Apparently it was quite common. Shocks me. The things I learned from Neil Gaiman, who's one of my favorite authors. But back to Dan. So I like the questioning of the instinctual animal versus the rational self, and wondering, like, is that me? Is that who I am? You know, it's I think one of the complicated things about being a human is wondering who you are in what sense. Are you a body? Are you a spirit? Are you something about, like, is it your mind? How is your mind separate from your body? In what way is the instinctual part of you you, or is the rational part of you you, or is it both? And I think it's both, but it's complicated. It really is. It's definitely something that I examined a lot with my brain damage, because I'm like, I always thought my brain was who I was, or my mind was who I was, but then I kind of separated it with, like, well, my brain is a body part that is injured, and that influences my mind, but it's not who I am. It's just, it's freaking battle of figuring out who I am. Anyway, tangent. I liked his lioness part, too, because it's like the connection of, you know, she's a mother, but she also goes after the children of the other species, and it's like she puts her motherness aside. So it's compartmentalization is kind of how I see that, and it's like he also wants to be able to compartmentalize his animal instincts and his logical side, but you can't necessarily. And then he talks about, like, the temptation of finding someone to have that animal connection with. You know, let your monster be free with the monster in me. The wild kind of chemistry encounters of lovers rather than the emotional bond of lovers. Because for when the beast and the thought mix, both will find doom. Because that's when you get your heart broken, is when you find someone who you have those connections with, both physically and mentally. You know, then you're just screwed. I really enjoyed this, Dan.
You broke me up. You broke my heart on both levels. Yeah. Nope. Are you there?
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry, I had to mute for a second, but share your thoughts.
Oh no, I was just saying, you know, like the mental and the physical. It's like some, you're saying this. Oh, you broke my heart on both levels, like, you know, physically and mentally.
It's true. We have 7 more minutes, and we have 2 more poems. I'm probably only going to have time for one, and one will get carried over. Let's see how it goes. I think you read that one, so it should be my turn to read. How I'm losing track of it with 2 of us, I don't know, but let's...
We both like to talk a lot, so then by the time we're done our comments, it's like, which one of us read?
Yeah. Through a Glass Darkly by Arliss. Light flattens out. Sorry, I'm going to start over again because I messed that up. Through a Glass Darkly by Arliss. Light flattens on the mirrored pond. Its still surface bounces at the rise of air bubbles. Their ripples ping of mature reeds disappear in the dark. Fish splash as I make the sign of food. I toss my arms across the shadows, fling pieces of fresh baguettes. Oh, to eat as the French, they sigh. The earth cannot be owned by this no man's land of nature and half-buried treasures. To exist is to violate ecosystems and tribes and the creaking backbone of history. Tragedy defiles our nature. We happily destroy what we cannot understand. We cannot understand our encounters with the other. We see ourselves only through a glass darkly. Poem.
It's like kind of a funny thing that I thought of, but I thought it, and I have to do it in the voice, like Agent Smith, he says, I realize that humanity is like a virus. it's kind of that sentiment here, because it's like he says, just our mere existence puts a strain on nature. And it's, you know, because we have that mental, that capacity, that intellectual ability to use our environment to our advantage, and that, and just, you know, even at the lower levels of what humanity used to do, like in terms of industrialization, that it just, nature became devastated. And thinking of the like with the flinging pieces of fresh baguette, oh, to eat the French as the French they die, you know, with the fish. And I just think of, like, you know, how people go fishing, and you know, from the fish's point of view, it's like, oh, we're getting lunch, and it's like, oh, you're getting baited so that you can get eaten. So overall, the that's what I got from this poem, was how just humanity's mere existence puts a strain on nature.
Yes, I agree. That was the key point for me too. To exist is to violate ecosystems and tribes and the creaking backbone of history. I mean, we pretty much destroy everywhere we go. And I think we probably, as humans, have the biggest impact on ecosystems than all of the other creatures, because we take more than we need. And most animals don't. They keep a balance. It's really depressing. I mean, he writes it in, like, kind of a fun way. Like, I can imagine if he read it in his voice, it'd have a bit of a bounce to it, because he has this, like, I don't know, energy to him where it's somehow a little bit idealistic, even within the stuff that should make us pessimistic. He says it in a really kind is not the right word, but it's like it's a gentle, accessible piece, not just like you know, it's like it's just the fact that the fish are like, oh, to eat us the French, but really feeding baguettes to animals is super bad. Like, bread is really terrible for the ducks and things like that. So, because, like, humans are dumb in that we think, like, oh, if we like it, then they'll like it, and then we destroy all things. So it's brilliant and true and depressing, and just it feels like very wise, and yeah, I agree with him, and I admire how he's able to express it in a way that is palatable.
Well, they say, like, with humanity, you can actually, like, have, there's the Holocene calendar that adds, like, a whole bunch of years for, because of humans shifting. It says humans shifted from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to agriculture, and the impact is so profound that you could, like, see it in the rock. Like, you know how, like, they measure time in the rocks and that, and like, mm-hmm. with the influence, like, this, oh, this is carbon and that. We've effed up things so badly that you can see it in the rock strata. So it's
wow.
Like, oh, wow. Yeah. So, like, you know,
that's
when they
awful.
Examine our planet, and, yeah, how many years from now, and, oh, look, that's the era where humans came. So, yeah. So before the show ends, and I just wanted to say I really enjoyed co-hosting with you. I was looking forward to this because I think we both have a unique way of looking at things and expressing things, and yeah, I was just looking forward to, like, putting our two viewpoint unique ways of looking to get at things together on these poems. So yeah, I was really looking forward to it, and I enjoyed it.
Ah, I am so glad that you were here. I definitely really enjoyed that as well. So hopefully you can come back next week. That would be cool.
I was able to come this week because I have – actually, I could probably yeah, next week I have that vacation, the one-week vacation that I finally gave myself because I've been bashing myself for that. I literally can't remember the last time I took a vacation. So, yeah, next week I'll be able to. But after that, actually, my Saturdays I have like usually early shifts, like really, like I have to get up obscenely early for the bus. But yeah, the next week I should be able to for at least part of the show, because that's when I have the vacation, and so like the it's like a week, and so like the Saturday and Sunday will be off after that. So
nice. All right. Well, thank you for calling. We are cut off. We have run out of time. So good night, everyone. And if you can still hear me, I can't live, but I think you can in the recording. Thank you to everyone who wrote, and I'll talk to you soon, Robbie. Good night.
Good night.